This was a great conversation where Dahlia and Emma shared their experience of ONMM early on in medical school and later during their clinical rotations of third and fourth year. Enjoy listening to their experiences and their big takeaways related to ONMM. So this is episode 106 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine Podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University. This evening, we have two of Michigan State's finest. They are medical students at the Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine. We have Emma Ford, a fourth-year student who will be doing her family medicine residency in Traverse City, Michigan, and Dahlia Hassan, currently a third-year medical student. They're on the podcast this evening to share their experience of osteopathic medicine while being on an OMM rotation. So Dahlia was in the outpatient setting here at our clinic at MSU, and Emma is actually currently on the McLaren OMM inpatient service. So I thank you both for coming on the podcast this evening and willingly sharing your stories about your guys' experience.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
I'm excited to hear what you're going to say. So let's dive in first to getting to know you both a little bit. Medical school is extremely demanding, but we know the importance of having hobbies outside of all of our medical studies. So let's start with maybe Emma. You're coming to the end of medical school. What are your favorite pastimes?
And I'll just say, the end of medical school, you get a lot more time to explore your hobbies. So Dahlia, you'll make it there.
I'm looking forward to it.
But I really enjoy downhill skiing in our cold months here in Michigan. So again, I'm going to chase that great white north up in Traverse City. I love reading. And recently I've picked up weightlifting in the last year, and it's been really great.
Really? Weightlifting. Cool. Skiing. What's your favorite place? Where is your favorite place to ski? Downhill ski.
Oh gosh, it's really hard. I'd have to say probably out in Summit County, Colorado. A Basin is really, really great.
A Basin. Okay. Nice. And you said, what else was it besides weightlifting?
Reading.
Reading. Okay. We're going to get to books after this question. But weightlifting, what kind of weightlifting are you doing?
Just kind of for fun and exercise, just at our local gym here in DeWitt. And it's been great. It's a lot of fun to get to know the people who come to the gym often and really feel myself getting stronger too.
You're becoming a gym rat?
Not quite there.
Not quite there. How did you get into it? Just curious what it was like to weightlift, or?
Absolutely. And I wanted something to be able to do some exercise that wasn't, I always find running very stressful and like, it's just put a lot of strain on my body. Where weightlifting, I was like, wow, I can go to someplace, do a 15-minute, 20-minute workout and not have to worry about it too much and be able to come back and get those studies done or do whatever I need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. As we age, especially past 40, so I should be doing this right now, but I'm currently not. We start to lose actual muscle bulk. And so it's really important as we age to weight train. So that's great that you're starting early. I need to emulate you a little bit more. Dahlia, what about you? What are the hobbies? You're in the heart of it right now, of medicine. You're in the ICU.
Yes, I actually just got down with the ICU, thankfully. It was a great experience. So now I'm on my psychiatry rotation. So that's, the pace has been definitely different from the ICU. It's like from having instruments and like procedures to now like understanding the mind more. So that's been really interesting. But as in regards to hobbies, since I'm at the heart of it, I've just felt so busy that sleep, I was going to answer sleep as my hobby, but I do like to read, not like adult books, like chapter books type thing. I've gotten back into like comic books or like Japanese anime, like kind of, or anime and manga. Manga is like the like reading version of anime. I really like pictures. It kind of just helps like soothe my eyes a bit after doing like a lot of reading for the day. So that's something that's been very consistent throughout my time in medical school. And I've noticed like as I get more busy, like that's something I always gear towards too. So reading anime and watching manga have been my hobbies for the past few years now. So definitely very different from Emma, but I'm hoping, Emma, that like I will be just like you, like kind of get into like exercising, like lifting and stuff like that. That's my goal.
What again is the manga?
Manga. Yeah. So manga, it's I want to say simply speaking, it's kind of like comic books, but it's more of like because it really is like words and pictures. So it's kind of, it's Japanese like literature pretty much in regards to that. So it's pretty much consists of like, I'll say it's pretty much like the counterpart of America, like comic books for the most part. For me, I just really like pictures and words together. My brain is just too fried from like reading words after words from like school and stuff. So that's kind of something I gear towards. And it's very interesting. So I really, really like it.
You don't watch anime?
Oh, no, I watch.
You prefer to read.
So there's both. So anime is like the visual. So like you're watching anime, like those are shows that you watch. And then like manga is like the book versions of anime, I want to say, for the most part. So the anime kind of like the anime comes from manga. Like the manga is like the first, you get the story and stuff like that. And then to visualize it better, that's where like they'll probably serialize it into an anime kind of thing. So that's so they're both different in different forms. So like manga, I guess manga is like book form of the story, and then like anime is like the TV version of it. So I think that's a simple way to explain it.
I appreciate that, because as you can tell, I don't know much about it. Even though I'm part Japanese.
Oh, really?
I am. My mother is 100% Japanese.
Interesting.
The only thing I know is Dragon Ball Z. You know what I mean? I've just watched a few episodes as a kid. But... Well, that's neat. Okay, let's go on to books. You both love to read. You're in medicine. Of course, you love to read. Emma, let's start with you. Books. What is a book recommendation that you have for us?
Yeah, I think the book that I just most recently read, it was actually on the plane ride back from Convocation this year. I finished it in the one sitting, The Midnight Night Library, which I've heard was great. And I was just like, oh, like finally I'll sit down and read this. And I was like crying in the plane. It was great.
Really? The Midnight Library, that's a new release, right?
I don't think it's super new, but I think it is. It is a newer book overall. It's not something from the early 1900s or something.
Yeah, that is on my list already. I saw it actually in the bookstore in the airport, actually. And I actually think coming back from Convo, I believe. I'm like, ooh, I'm putting this on my list.
It was fantastic. Definitely, like, if you're somebody, I'm somebody that cries at movies, cries at TV shows, cries at the sad animal commercials. So if you're somebody that's prone to crying and you don't like to do that in public, read this book at home.
Can you give us a teaser?
Oh, it's fabulous. It's all about Nora Seed is our main character here. And she gets to explore what her lives would be like if she had made different decisions. I think we all have those times where like, oh, what if I would have chosen A over B? She gets to truly live out those experiences throughout her life.
Oh, she gets to live out these experiences?
Like, yes.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's really interesting. I'm more excited to read it now. Okay, that's great. That's great. Dahlia, what about you?
For me, so I actually did read this book. It didn't have pictures in it. but one of my favorite books, I really like mystery novels. So one of them is Agatha Christie. It's called And Then There Were None. So pretty much like 10 strangers are lured to like an island, like an island mansion. And at dinner, and, like no one knows each other, but they were all invited by a certain individual. So at the dinner that night, there's a recorded message that accuses each of them of having a guilty secret. And then by the end of the night, one of the guests are dead. And then they can't call for help because they're stranded on this island by a violent storm. And one by one, like they begin to die, or someone like one by one, like they each get killed. So they're all like kind of just trying to figure out who among them is the killer. And the question is, will any of them survive? So this one's a really interesting book. It's a classic. I don't know if, like, if you guys ever read it, but I think Agatha Christie is a really great mystery novel writer. For sure, yeah.
She's so good. Yeah. Such a great author.
I'm not sure that I've ever read any books by her, but that I'll put that one on my list as well.
Yes.
Okay. What about movie, documentaries, TV shows, Emma?
I think for me, this is where I dip a little bit into my more anime side. But Netflix's Bee and Puppycat has been my comfort show for the entirety of medical school. It actually started out as a YouTube series of animated series there, and then kind of transitioned into a full Netflix show.
Bean puppy cat?
Bee, just like a the insect.
Bee puppy cat.
Yeah.
So what's it about?
It's about this. It's really, I don't know if it has a great plot. It's really about this girl who seems to be in her 20s, and she takes care of this pet that suddenly comes into her life that may be a puppy, maybe a cat, hence puppy cat. And they go on interdimensional adventures together. It doesn't have great plot. It's just a lot of like really pleasant colors and like happy themes, and the music's really good. So it's a great show to just turn on and make dinner.
I feel like my wife would really love that.
I need to watch it.
It's really, really good. I would definitely recommend it.
And you've been watching this all throughout medical school.
Yeah, this has been my comfort. Like, turn this on, and it's just like very silly. Like the puppy cat character, the animal character, like doesn't actually speak English. Like he speaks a nonsense language, but they have his little subtitles at the bottom, and it's just a lot of nonsense, and it's very funny.
Sounds like a great show after a full day of medical school.
It's a great turn your brain off and just watch pretty colors and things go on screen. Yeah,
nice music and animals. Nice. Dahlia, what do you have?
I think you guys know the answer to this one. definitely anime. I'm into a couple shows, but my one all-time favorite anime, I used to watch this in my childhood. It's still ongoing. They've reached over 1,000 episodes. It's called Detective Conan. So it's another mystery type story. And it's pretty much about this high school detective who is really smart. He solves a bunch of cases for the police. But then one day he got too curious and like tried to eavesdrop on a conversation. And one of the suspects kind of knocks him out and like feeds him a poison that turns him into a small child. And basically he lives with his best friend's dad plus his best friend. And then like they solve, he helps him, who his best friend's dad also is a detective, but he's not a really good one. So like pretty much him as a child tries to help him out and they solve cases together, but they don't know who he actually is. They just think he's just some random kid that's related to the high school detective, and that they were nice enough to like take care of him and stuff all this time. So it's been going on since like 1995, and they're still going. So there's a lot of new episodes. So I really love watching that show. They still have several different cases. They always have something new. It's not like repetitive, which I really like. So it's not as popular as like Naruto or Pokemon, but it's popular in Japan. It's not popular in the US as much, but I really, really like it because it's really nostalgic for me. And then just me continuing on watching it all this time has been such a full circle moment. So it's one of my favorites.
That's fascinating. Over 1,000
shows. Which is very crazy because a lot of anime shows, like if they get piloted and like series is ordered, they last about 12 episodes. Or if it's really popular, maybe like 2 or 3 seasons. So about like 36 to 60 episodes. So this one is really popular in Japan for the most part, and they've been going for over 1,000. So it's very crazy.
That is incredible.
I'm adding that to my list.
Yes, please.
This is one of the incredible perks of the podcast. I get all these incredible book, movie, TV show recommendations. It's wonderful. So thank you both for sharing. So let's switch gears and dive into our topic about osteopathic medicine and both of your experiences on your rotations, one in the inpatient setting, one in the outpatient setting. So I think it'll be interesting to compare and contrast. But I wanted to start out asking you both, and we can start with you, Emma, what your experience was with OMT in medical school. What was it like? What did you like? What did you not like? What did you want more of? You just share that with the audience.
Yeah, I think my entire class had a really interesting kind of experience with OMT, specifically because we were that COVID year. We started medical school in 2020. Nothing could be in person. And I remember I was already excited about osteopathic manipulation coming into medical school. And I was like, I need to get involved in every organization I can. How can we help get this back into person? Of course, safely with all the different regulations of the time. But this isn't something that when we were watching our Zoom sessions online and I was trying to practice on family members at home, I was like, this really isn't sinking in yet. So being able to get involved in those groups and organizations is just such a fond part of medical school for me, because it was the way to get involved and get in person, even masked and face shields and everything else. It was just great to be able to see people and start to work on things. And I think if you really dove yourself into it, like I did, you had a fantastic experience. I was able to treat patients in our free student clinic. I was able to treat student athletes in our student athlete clinic here at Michigan State. So really able to make a fantastic thing out of a difficult situation, I think, for most medical students in my year.
Yeah. And how did you know about osteopathic manipulation? Did you know about it coming into medical school? And if so, how?
I did. So I always joke that it was my mom said I wasn't very good at math, but I was really good at science in high school. So she's like, you should be a doctor. You can do this. I believe in you. Mm-hmm. So she took from that and found Michigan State had a summer camp that was actually sponsored by the College of Osteopathic Medicine. And that's where I first got involved with OMM actually in high school, which was fabulous. And then through college was able to be a part of like the undergraduate student osteopathic medical association and something called OsteoChamps and the OMSP program specifically at Michigan State that kind of helped be a feeder program and continue and encourage that interest in osteopathic manipulative medicine and the tenets of osteopathic medicine.
Wow. So you were educated about osteopathic medicine since high school.
I was very, very lucky.
Yeah, truly. Now I understand where the skills and knowledge comes from. Okay. I'm putting things together.
It all makes sense now.
All the puzzle pieces falling into place.
And you were the SAO president as well last year, correct?
I was, yes, for, 2 years ago in 2021 to 2022. That might, you may have to fact check my numbers there.
That's right. 2021, 2022. Okay. Great. What about you, Dahlia? Tell us about your experience. Well, you're still in medical school.
Yes.
Up until now, what has your experience been?
So I grew up in Illinois. So I had an after-school medical, like, school program where you kind of, it's, like, simulating, like, as a medical student, like, what the curriculum was like, but that was at an allopathic school, so I wasn't fortunate enough to really have that early exposure for OMM or OMT until, like, when I was, like, applying for colleges, and, like, I was really into, like, the DO philosophy, and then I watched a few videos on, like, what OMT is. And to be quite honest, like the video being like seeing a video and going in person to experience OMT is vastly different. But I knew at the time I was like, this is something I want to do. This is another additional skill set to have to really help treat patients. It wasn't until first semester of medical school where after we had our practical, OMM practicals at the end of the semester. And the goal of the practical is you find something, it was pretty much a simple like FRS, ERS of the thoracic spine or thoracic spine. And, you know, my friend had a simple FRS and you're also supposed to like verbalize what you're doing so that like the person that's grading you isn't going to like ask questions. They know that you know your stuff. So for me, like I verbalized like my like diagnosis and treatment really well. However, like I just didn't really have enough practice like hands-on as much as I should have. And like my words were saying one thing, but then like my, I don't know, like kind of my, like how I was executing that with my hands, I was making it more complicated than it needed to be. And I'll just say this, it was Dr. Blakemore that had, was grading us. He was my professor first semester, you know, and then he checked and he's like, okay, everything's fine. But then like afterwards he was like, well, if you like, and he really like, this is something I'll always remember for the rest of my life. He was like, well, you have the right idea. So you probably would do really well in a written exam, but you really, if you're going to use OMT, you really need to like practice and apply it really well to your patients. And I was like, oh my goodness, like this is, it finally hit me that I'm like, I'm planning on using this for the rest of my life. Like I really need to like get more experience how to use OMT so that I can really be confident enough to actually treat and successfully treat my patients in the future. So that really ignited the path of like, you know, just really get into ONMM. So that's when I had applied for the free student clinic that Emma was running. And, you know, honestly, Emma, you really did make me feel really assured that like, this is something that's like possible, that I can gain these skills to really treat patients and stuff like that. So that's something that I really truly appreciate and something I'll remember forever. And the more that I was in the OMM clinic, the more I felt more confident in like treating patients or at least like diagnosing as well. So that's, and then after that, I just really loved like the field of ONMM. Like it was just the amount of things that we can do with our hands and additional resources to really heal the body and really utilizing those osteopathic principles is something that's truly extraordinary because with the OMM clinic, we got access to additional didactic lectures on understanding just the scope of OMM. And that's something that I truly cherish because it really like opened my mind up and I just didn't feel as rigid as I felt like that first semester of medical school. So OMM has definitely a special place in my heart. So that's kind of my journey so far. And I'm really excited to use that in my practice in the future.
Yeah, that's great. Have you shared that story with Dr. Blakemore ever?
To be quite honest, I think I had mentioned it at like, just like not the whole story, but to be honest, I feel like he didn't remember, like, it's not a bad thing, but like because he teaches so many students, he does recognize me, but I don't think he remembers that specific conversation, but I remember that and that's all that matters.
Sure. And it's just neat. I think it's a great reminder that no matter if we're the student or we're the physician, I mean, and it doesn't matter who we're talking to, it's always interesting to me how our words sometimes resonate with people and you don't even realize it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes can make a very lasting impact and you don't even mean them to. So I think it's just something to always to be aware of, like how important our words, the choice of our words and the intention behind our words and maybe the positivity or the motivation as well within our words, how important that is, and probably even more so with us being physicians.
That's very true.
So, yeah, that's a great story. Mm-hmm. That's a great, great story. Okay, Emma, going back to you. Why did you want to do an inpatient OMM rotation?
I think the biggest thing for me was just really becoming more confident using OMM in the hospital. experiences were in those first 2 years of medical school, really with osteopathic manipulation. Into my third year, because of the great luck of my base hospital having an osteopathic manipulative medicine team who would come and see patients, oftentimes some of the physicians, some of the residents would say, oh, well, you shouldn't do the OMM. That should be reserved for the team. But sometimes then they still wouldn't consult. And I'm like, wait, no, please let this happen.
Where were you? Where was your base hospital?
At McLaren Greater Lansing.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So it was just something where I was like, I really want to feel more confident, understand, and also learn a lot of the techniques. I feel like I learned a lot of great, like, muscle energy therapy, more direct techniques. And I'm like, but I wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable using each one of those techniques on somebody in the ICU, on a neonate, on some of these really delicate patients who you become so worried on how can I treat them with hands-on manipulation?
Mm-hmm. So you wanted to kind of build up your experience and your confidence using OMT in the hospital setting.
Yes, exactly.
Got it. Now, in your upcoming residency in Traverse City, I know you've mentioned that you will be using OMT. Mm-hmm. Will you have the opportunity to do that in the hospital, or will that also primarily be in the outpatient setting?
I think I'll be able to be able to do both. I'm very, very excited about the residency that up at Traverse City at Munson. They have a lot of inpatient time. I think we spend 4 of our 12 first months in the inpatient setting, and you can continue doing a lot of inpatient. Some of their physicians even go on to be more hospitalist or have part of their practice be hospitalist, which is almost unusual nowadays for family medicine physicians. So I think that's something where definitely I will be in the hospital setting. They do a lot of deliveries, actually do a lot of OB care. So I think I'll be seeing a lot of neonates, a lot of infants, a lot of patients. And I think in the outpatient setting too, they're also just hurting up there for some osteopathic manipulation. With the residency having DOs be there, oftentimes their schedules are booked out for months and months in the outpatient setting. So I'm sure sprinkling some of that into the inpatient will be great. And it'll be nice to be able to say, listen, I did this for a month. I have a lot of confidence in this. I kind of have seen the boundaries of where I feel comfortable, and then can continue asking the DO physicians up there, like, what do you think about this? And start picking their brains and hopefully help them recognize that they too can start using osteopathic manipulation in the inpatient setting.
Yeah. That's awesome. You also will have some accompaniment from the good Dr. Pete Nemus, who is an ER resident trained physician who is now a ONMM fellow here at MSU. And he's up there in Charlevoix. So he's hoping to go back up there and open up an outpatient practice. So, but he said the same thing. There's such a need up there, and people seem to gravitate towards that kind of medicine. So yeah. That's great. That is great. Anything else that you wanted to add?
No, I think that for most people, when you kind of describe OMM and describe helping align the body to help it heal and feel better, they're like, wow, that sounds fantastic. Yeah, let's do that. And then after experiencing it, they're like, okay, how do I sign up? How do I get more of this? So we'll just need more and more physicians to gain that confidence. And I think a lot of it is that you just have to do it. And it's you know, you just keep practicing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Keep practicing, keep learning about physiology, honing in on your anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you start thinking that way, it becomes so, so interesting and so dynamic when you're treating. It's never routine, never protocol like you know. Yeah, that's great. Okay, Dahlia, we haven't forgotten about you.
No worries. I really appreciate the inpatient insight, because that's something I was also very curious about. So thank you for sharing, Emma.
Why Dahlia? Recommend.
Oh, sorry.
No. Why, Dahlia, did you choose to do an outpatient OMM rotation?
Yes. So I will have to say this was the best decision that I've ever made. And I'm so glad I thought of this like kind of last minute. So at the time I had this open elective spot in February, which was very early on, especially as a third year medical student. So I wanted to I tried getting like a requirement out of the way, like a surgical elective, but like all the fourth years like took up the surgical electives, which no fault there, like they have to finish the requirement. So I was left with like, okay, like I'll pick anything. And at the time, infectious disease was open. And I was like, okay, like I'll do that. I'm interested in that, like all that stuff. But then like I was like lying in bed one night and I was thinking about it and I was like, oh my goodness, like I could do like OMM, and I'm here and I'm fortunate enough to be at McLaren Greater Lansing as my base hospital, but in the Lansing area, and the MSU OMM clinic is right down the road. So I had reached out to Dr. Rowan and Dr. Lippert and they were more than happy for me to be there. And then it was just a bunch of communication there. So that's kind of how I got into, because I think, and then I was left deciding between infectious disease and OMM, but then I was like, this is such a critical time in my medical school career where, like, you know, once I leave, it'll be a lot harder to kind of find more valuable time to kind of learn different things. I'm sure that's not the case, but that's kind of how I felt at the time. So I was like, I'd rather utilize, like gain as much skills as possible as someone like just becoming a future physician in general. So it became an easier decision after that. So I had decided to do outpatient OMM, and I did wanted to do outpatient OMM versus OMM inpatient was because I still felt like my foundation was kind of cracking in regards to, because it's been several months since I've actually like done OMT on a patient. I would practice on a friend here and there, but I really wanted to kind of refresh on my skills and also gain that confidence back that I kind of lost several months ago, especially after taking boards. So I did that, and then it was very awesome, like how my schedule was at the outpatient OMM, because I got to work with the residents and attendings, and everybody has their own distinct style in regards to their treatment or how they treat their patients. And it kind of really like touched my heart in a fact that like OMT is an art. It's an art that, you know, accomplishes the same goal, and that is to like treat the patient, both structure and function, which are both reciprocally interrelated. And it was very interesting to see just everybody's own way of treating patients. Some people like to do a mix from like MET to myofascial to balance or still. And then some people are strictly MET, or some people are strictly like myofascial or indirect techniques. So spending time with each physician was really nice, because then it felt like I was gaining those skills as well. Like I was kind of holistically kind of preparing my own art of OMT that I'd like to use. And that was something really cool. And at the time, Dr. DeStefano, a legend, as everyone likes to say, which is very much true, was retiring. And I remember the first week, she's like, do you have any questions for me? And myself being like empty headed, and I'm like, I have no questions for you, but I'll like observe and like hear what you have to say to like all the other residents that are going to come talk to her about their patients. And just reading the Greenman Principles of Manual Medicine textbook that she wrote right in front of her was just such a surreal moment. Like I was just fangirling all around. So this rotation was such a great rotation to have. And I think I lost what question you had, like what the question was, but that's kind of my experience.
That's fine. That was great. Follow-up question to you, Dahlia. So you mentioned that something that really stood out to you was that each provider or resident had their own style, and OMT seems to be more of an art. Mm-hmm. Why was that interesting, or why did that call to your attention?
I think it called to my attention because when I think of art, I think of, you know, just unlimited forms of expression that kind of reaches a goal of visualizing the audience member in a sense, or the viewer for the most part. So for me, in that case, as mentioned before, it was kind of like you have the provider or resident that's, you know, that sees the problem in front of them, which is a patient. And like that, for them kind of looking at that problem or whatever diagnosis or dysfunction that they have, they were able to treat it in multiple, like in servitude different ways and whatever they felt was comfortable for the patient. And then what I think of the viewer of the art, I guess, because the patient, I guess, is the artwork maybe, but like the viewer of the art, I kind of correlate that to kind of like what the final piece is or what the finishing form is, I guess, if that makes sense. And that would be like, if that function has been, the body's function has been restored based off of like how it was treated by the provider, if that makes sense. I hope I didn't butcher that, but that's kind of like how I've like looked at it during my time in the rotation. So it just really, it felt really cool kind of seeing that, like seeing just that, like kind of that metaphor for the most part, like that metaphor of just the art of like treating that patient using the osteopathic principles and applying that with OMT in different ways. So that's kind of what I found really interesting. And I can go into depth of like each provider too. And I actually worked with you for a little bit too. So yeah, I think you like to use like a different set of techniques too, but you really, you definitely like view it differently than how other providers would.
Sorry. Yeah, it's always interesting to me. We all are, we're unique individual people with a unique background and unique interests. And every person that we treat is very unique as well. So it's always interesting how certain personalities seem, I don't know, to be drawn to certain techniques or are maybe drawn more to the emotional side of dysfunction, and other people are more drawn to the anatomical, biomechanical side of dysfunction. I think that's interesting, and I think they're all valid, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think we as people are extremely complex and we're extremely multifaceted, and I don't think that one technique or approach necessarily is better than the other. I'm sure some people would disagree with me, but yeah. So I think we each have our own art. Yeah, mm-hmm. That is. Yeah. I don't know what else to say about that, but I want to say something. I just don't know how to formulate it. Did you want to mention anything?
Yes. I think maybe I can go into a little bit specifics. Like, for example, like Dr. Zatkin, who I believe is the director of the ONMM residency program at MSU. Am I correct on that, Dr. Green?
You are.
Okay, perfect. Mm-hmm. So with him, I worked with him one afternoon, and he utilizes a lot of muscle energy techniques. So definitely really like he looks at the, and he visualizes the anatomy and like kind of uses like his, like kind of utilizes that and really kind of visualizes like where the dysfunction is at. And then using MET to kind of accomplish that goal of restoring that body's natural function, which is definitely the opposite spectrum of Dr. Sina, who's a lot more myofascial indirect. And what's really nice is I actually appreciated that because we don't really get enough indirect techniques like practice in medical school during our OMM labs. So I was really practicing that, and I was amazed by like how he was able to restore like the patient's dysfunctions. And like, I kid you not, like there was a like older patient who has like has history of osteoporosis and like kyphosis in her spine. And you can really visualize that she had like a right rib hump, and like he used like indirect technique. Like normally for me, I'd be like, okay, like let me go one by one through the like the spinal segments and kind of just like really trying to restore like that FRS or whatever that was there. But for him, he was just utilizing like myofascial, he was using the percussor, all these things, and like right before my eyes, like it was completely balanced, like there was no rib hump whatsoever. And I just, that kind of blew my mind a little bit. And I was like, oh, like I really don't have to put too much stress on my hands, and kind of utilizing just the kind of the quantum mechanics of like the natural, like the surroundings of the body and stuff like that, and realizing that you don't need as much force to kind of restore the body's natural like alignment and stuff like that. And what I've also noticed too, especially after working with Dr. Sina, is that everybody, and I think you mentioned it too, Dr. Green, where like a lot of people, a lot of the providers' backgrounds are very much reflected on how they treat their patients. So he has a lot more of this kind of like physics, computer science, like kind of just this really like elemental background that he has. And it really shows when he's treating patients. I want to think who else is, I forgot, but that's one of the main ones. And I'm like, but I was seeing people's backgrounds really being reflected on their treatment as well. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, it makes sense in a sense that like we have taken all that we've experienced in life, and that's kind of how we view the world. And this is just such a micro part of that. So that's something that I thought that was really interesting too.
Yeah. Emma, did you want to add anything?
I think Dahlia put it fabulously. It's the art, it's everyone's backgrounds, it's what you're comfortable with, what you've seen work on other patients. It's always so interesting. I love seeing all the combination of different treatments. It's fabulous.
Yeah. You know, I think with those indirect techniques, what I have heard some providers say and mention, this is in relation to how much force you're putting into the body. You know, I've heard providers say, well, put in as much force as the body tells you. I'm like, oh, I don't know. What does that mean? Well, I think that sometimes maybe we try too hard. You know, we're mm-hmm. go-getters. You know, we went to medical school. We're go-getters. We're high achievers. You know, we want to fix the problem. But I think there's absolutely inherent knowledge in the body. And with some indirect techniques where you're using, and you're taking the body to the position of ease and then allowing the body itself to unwind that myofascially and just go where it wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. And as I have progressed through my residency, I think I have evolved. I don't know if evolved. I have been open to doing more of the indirect techniques and using less force and trying to let the body tell me, what does it want? What does it need? How much force does it need to unwind? Is it unwinding? Okay. And it has been interesting. It kind of has been a little bit of a paradigm shift. So yeah, that's been neat. Dr. Zakian as well spoke about last week in didactics how he sees OMM as he describes it to patients as we are functional neurologists. And I was like, I kind of like that. And he was teaching us how to do muscle testing. And so I've been doing a lot of that too. Patients coming in with low back pain, I will test their bilateral psoas strength. And in many patients, one side is weaker than the other. When I muscle test it, and I actually, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the muscle testing. It's a little bit different mm-hmm. than the 1 through 5 grading scale. But anyway, muscle test them. One side is weaker. Treat the somatic dysfunctions that you find. Retest the muscle and it's stronger. And I'm like, whoa, that's cool. Like real time, you know, and the patient sees that, the provider sees that, and it's so gratifying, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very fun to do. So anyway, I kind of went on a tangent, but
no, that's honestly, like, that's kind of what I experienced as well. Like sometimes, like depending on the patient, like they either need a small push from the provider in a sense of like pressure or like treatment modalities, or some people might need a little bit more intense work. But it's always definitely like a trial and error sometimes. But at the end of it all, you're promoting like the body's natural tendency towards self-healing. You're just giving that push, and that's really all that the body needs. And that's something I was very fortunate enough to kind of visualize with my own eyes at the clinic. Because when you have like OMM labs, like you're working with medical students, and like, no, none of us like really have anything wrong with us, thankfully. So you're not really kind of visualizing like the before and after as much, or at least it's very minimal. So that's something I truly got to appreciate. And I also got to appreciate like how, like, cause there's continuity in the outpatient setting. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing patients for several months at a time. And, it's so interesting when, like, before we go see a patient, like the resident or attending would be like, oh, like when I first saw them, they were this, this, and that. Like, it was so, we had to work through so many treatments just for them to be like, you know, to like kind of restore them back into a natural alignment. And then just seeing the patient, like, you know, in the room, they look completely normal. And I'm just like, I kind of wish I saw the before, like with a lot of these patients, because it would have been really interesting to see. But I believe it 100%.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, the continuity comes with time, and especially on the inpatient was incredible, being able to see patients from day to day to day. Also learning how to balance treatments when I was kind of in this mindset of, like, you know, you treat someone once every month, maybe depending on their schedule, maybe once every week or 2 weeks if you were lucky, to daily treatments where you can't, and also they're in the hospital, so they've got other things going on. You can't necessarily use these really aggressive, hardcore techniques. You're not going to treat them for an hour and then come back the next day and treat them for another hour. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that continuity is just something that you gain as you go through medical school. And then once we're in practice, eventually we'll get our own cases that we can hold near and dear to our hearts, that we see them flourish and grow and improve.
Yes. And actually, I was very curious, because I was fortunate enough during my ICU rotation to watch Angie, one of the third year residents, do like OMT on a patient. So like, I was kind of wondering where, like, you see certain patients every day. And one of them, I think, is a post CABG, which is coronary artery bypass graft. I think that's what it was. Mm-hmm. So Emma, I didn't know if that was like, if there was patients that or like other patients where you see every day. So could you explain a bit more of like what kinds of patients that you saw in the inpatient setting?
I was going to say, actually, I'll defer to Dr. Green first, just as somebody who's done this far more often than I. But I was seeing patients typically on the daily, as long as that they were okay with it and would like to be treated again.
Yeah. Right now, just your experience on the inpatient setting. What did you learn? What do you continue to learn? Maybe an interesting case.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things that I've learned is just figuring out how to approach patients in the hospital. I figured out definitely how to consent patients, like, you know, in the ER setting, especially with, you know, that chest pain, and we've ruled out the cardiac causes. It's like, oh, I've got to, let me check for a rib, because if I put that back in and you feel great, like, fantastic, I feel so much better about sending you home. But especially with the neonates, with ICU patients, with these patients just post their CABGs, who are quite ill at the time. And, you know, and sometimes even they've had labile blood pressures, labile heart rates, really learning to not be afraid to try, but also learning the signs of what are the things that we should be aware of to know when the OMT may be not necessarily causing harm, but disturbing the patient in a way that they are just so ill at this moment that the extra touch, the extra stimulation might be too much for them. So certainly learning that in the ICU with just some of our very, very ill patients. We have a patient right now, actually, that we're treating, and his spouse is very, very excited for us to come in and treat him every day, even though he's moving more in a palliative care, more comfort direction. She would like us to continue still treating him just to provide that comfort. And then, of course, with the neonates, I love seeing a baby. It's always so much fun, and learning how it's okay to treat them, and how much pressure, how you can use things, how you can hold their little heads with their bones not fused yet, and start to feel those somatic dysfunctions and help work those out, and see from the day to day, one day where they're really biting on your finger when you're testing their suckle, and the next day they're on mom's breast not wanting to get off because they're cluster feeding, and both mom and baby are so happy and feeling healthy, and their suckle has improved so greatly.
Yeah. Is there any particular case that stood out to you, Emma? And if not, that's totally fine too.
Well, I think, I don't know if you're also thinking of this case, Dr. Green, but one of the patients we were able to treat, of course, keeping in compliance with his personal information, but he was a male in his mid-40s or so, had a really deep injury to his right neck that left a significant scar. And ever since that injury, he had had tinnitus, so apologize for the pronunciation there, but ringing in his right ear that he said it sounded like he was standing next to a semi constantly, which I just can't even imagine having that constant noise going on all the time. So we were recruited because of this kind of neck tightness, I think was the initial consult. And then coming in, hearing his whole story, we're like, oh my goodness, let's like think through this. Let's try treating out some of his cranial as well as his cervical, and he had like 50% improvement of his ringing after just one treatment. It only lasted for a few hours, but he was in tears. He was just so grateful to see that something could work, even though, like, you know, the ringing might come back and might have come back even as bad as it was before. He's like, this is a chance for me to move past this in my life. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that case, Dr. Green, but he was a fabulous person to work with.
Yeah, that was a really interesting case. I mean, it was so cool. It's so wonderful when people get better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for their sake, but also as the provider performing the treatment, it's also very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
I think for this patient, it was so invigorating to see how much hope it gave mm-hmm. him, because he thought, I'm going to have this semi running next to my ear for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then to treat him, I mean, you and I both treated him and the other team members did as well. But for him, even to get the 50% of improvement for what did he say? Like up to 4 hours?
Yeah.
Was quite impactful for him.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we were thinking through the anatomy. I remember
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, we were talking about
the tensor tympani and which cranial nerves are innervating which parts, because he had some cranial nerve 5 numbness and tingling that had persisted since the injury, and we were trying to pull all these things together to try to understand, like, anatomically and biomechanically, is there something that we're missing that we're starting to get at with our treatment, but is there a way we can hone that treatment into one specific part and possibly provide him even greater relief?
Yeah, so we were doing a deep dive in anatomy, that's right, and thinking mm-hmm. about the tympani and what was that innervated by, and all mm-hmm. of these nerves are coming out of the sphenopalatine ganglia. Mm-hmm. Let's try to myofascially release that. And that was extremely painful and tender for him.
Yeah.
Sure if that helped or not.
I think it did. I don't know if you were able to see him after that. He did take the next day off of OMM. So Dahlia, that was one of the times we didn't see him the next day, because we came in and he was like, I would like a break, please. That was a lot yesterday. But we came in the next day and he's like, you know, like, it was a lot, but like, I really, really love what you do. If you could do some of the other things, but maybe don't do that ganglion again for a little bit. That was.
that was interesting, because the amount of pressure was almost just like resting my hand on, you know, again, it was very, very minimal, but it was so, I think, inflamed.
Yeah.
And angry.
Yeah, because it had been this way for 4 or 5 months at this point. He had the injury 4 or 5 months before we saw mm-hmm. him, right?
That sounds correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it seemed to be the kind of inferior and posterior traction.
Yeah.
Like with one finger in the actual external auditory meatus.
Mm-hmm.
Inferiorly and posteriorly really gave him a lot of relief.
Mm-hmm.
And then working the deep fascia of the cervical spine.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite an interesting case. I would love to follow up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope he comes into clinic, because I know that we gave him several cards to make sure that he had them and would be able to follow up with us, because he truly loved it. So,
yeah, it would be a very interesting case study to write up as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting. Like, do you both ever think about, like, do you ever think about with, like, working with patients who have these interesting cases, like, what could have been if you guys hadn't intervened at that time? Like, maybe, like, you have saved this patient from, like, countless consult appointments with, like, neurology or, like, surgeons or whatever, like, people would think this pathology would go. So it's really cool that you guys were able to, like, kind of provide this intervention and, like, relief without having to, like, without wasting, like, resources or patients, like, resources and money and stuff like that. So I was curious to see, like, do you guys ever think about, like, had you not intervened, like, what if?
Go ahead, Emma.
I was going to say, it's one of those things, it's always difficult because you always want to do what's best, and it's always tough to be that person who realizes, especially as somebody going into family medicine, where we have so many different things that we know and don't know, and you get patients from other family physicians who might have different skill sets and assets than you, and you get them in front of you and you're like, oh my gosh, I recognize this. This is blah, 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 blah. And it's just that it's one of those zebras or one of those things where you're just like, oh, all the pieces are falling in place. And then you realize that you can intervene. You've seen this kind of, like, chaos of them going to all these additional appointments, spending all these healthcare dollars themselves and through insurance and through everything else on these massive workups, when it's like, oh, it would have, if you just had done a sleep study, this could have been over or what have you. And you just happen to ask that one right question. So I tend to think that, like, we just all try our best every time, and you hope you intervene. You hope that you give this patient a good follow-up and that you're giving them the tools that they need to continue to help themselves. So I just always hope for the best for them, but my trick is always my badge stays in my car. And as soon as it comes off, I try to stop worrying about the patients. They try not to bring them home with me all the way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's probably a healthy practice. I think you're very right. I think you're very right. I guess, Dolly, to answer your question, I don't know. I don't think about that very often. I don't know why. It just doesn't cross my mind. But what I do think about is, I mean, OMT doesn't help every single patient, and that's for a myriad of reasons, but it doesn't hurt to try. Mm-hmm. I think that the stakes are very low as far as potentially hurting a patient. Now, in the inpatient setting, we definitely need to do our due diligence and speak to the nurse and get consent, and the health oftentimes is more fragile. So it's a little bit more delicate. In the outpatient setting, I would say pretty confidently that there's minimal risk. We actually did have, in Dr. Zatkin's time as a program director, our first adverse outcome with OMT. A patient had a mastectomy for breast cancer and then had radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the providers was treating them with HVLA to the ribs in that area. And it seemed that the HVLA caused a rib fracture.
Mm-hmm.
But typically that doesn't happen. That's very, very, very rare. I would not do HVLA on a person who has had radiation to their breasts on those ribs, right?
You know, but it's something you don't even think about sometimes, where you sometimes just smack yourself on the forehead and you're like, well, of course. But
right.
in the moment, you see somebody in front of you who appears healthy to you on the outside, and you go to your techniques that you really enjoy.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Sometimes you just get into a routine. Segment's not moving. Let's make it move. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right. OMT is an awesome tool. I think we need to ask the right questions, mm-hmm. to know our anatomy, to never stop learning. I think that's so, so important, to be humble enough to ask questions when we don't know or admit that we're wrong. OMT is a great tool. We as DOs, we all have been trained in it. And keeping up your skills, as you both have done, is, I applaud you for doing that. And I think we'll give you the opportunity to help more people, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I don't know if that answered your question, Dahlia.
No, you both answered it perfectly. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that either of you wanted to share about your rotation?
So I think the most important thing, every day during that rotation, every patient that we saw, like the first most important thing is to the establishment of trust between the provider and patient, really like kind of communicating with them the process, what the provider is doing with their hands, how it benefits their body, how it restores them to its like natural function. But we also, I think what's really important to note is that the people who are using OMT really are getting valuable input from the patient and respecting that and valuing that, validating that, and going about their treatment process. So the patient is always part of the core through it all. It's not just the providers and residents or, you know, just like, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to do this and that on this part of the body, this patient's body, We have to always take into account what the patient wants and like how, and making sure the patient understands like what we're doing, and stuff like that. So really establishing that relationship and trust is the most important thing before doing anything else. And I think that kind of resonates with not just in like ONMM, but it resonates throughout the whole field of medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Go ahead, Emma.
Yeah, I was going to say that always remembering that patient is the number one head of the care team because they know their body better than everyone else. And I think osteopathic manipulative medicine helps remind us of that very acutely because you are asking them how they feel after a treatment, after you've manipulated something. And truly, even though if you feel the tissue texture has gotten better, if they're like, no, there's still like something there, then you continue looking, right? So it's always remembering to include them in the care team in every single discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important explaining what we're doing, as mm-hmm. you mentioned. Explain what OMT is, which can be challenging, and also convey the idea that this kind of medicine is a little bit different than a lot of the medicine that they probably experienced, in that a lot of their healing is done by them. And we're just kind of a spark. We're just kind of a facilitator. Mm-hmm. Our job, and the reason why we went to medical school, was to try to help to understand why they're having this discomfort. And then giving them the tools and the education and ideas and ways of how they can implement whatever that may be to correct the dysfunction by themselves. I like to tell my patients, to make this very clear, it's 80-20. And that's just to make a point, mm-hmm. right? 20% is my job to figure out why you're coming in today, why you have this chief complaint. And then 80% is on you to whatever that may be, you know, change whatever that may be, whether that's sleep, whether that's diet, whether that's routine exercise, whether that's some kind of movement practice or all of the above, and trying to gauge how interested they are in taking on those tasks. Because some people come in and they're just like, fix me. And I'm like, okay, it doesn't work like that. This doesn't work like that. If that's your idea, this is the wrong place for you to be. And yeah. So that's a conversation. And sometimes, most of the time, that's an ongoing conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Emma. Do you want to say something else about that?
No, that's all. Just agreeing.
Okay. Anything that you guys didn't like about your rotation, or you wanted more of, or ways that it could improve?
I think one of the biggest things, and it's just in general, I think as osteopathic medical students, I think people sometimes struggle with this, is the learning how to define osteopathic manipulative medicine in therapy and introducing ourselves as physicians and these things. I feel like that was the one thing that I felt like I took away from this was we saw so many patients and they'd be like, oh, so like you're physical therapy. Oh, so you're massage therapists, which both physical therapists and massage therapists do fantastic work. And I don't want to dissuade their professions or talk down to them at all. But it's like, no, but like I also learned the anatomy and I did these things as well. And so I think really like you had just said about learning how to define osteopathic manipulative medicine and our role in helping patients through it. I think that's something we can all work on and learn how to describe ourselves of something different than, oh, we're like chiropractors, but different. Mm-hmm. Cause that's not always the best description of the tools and the abilities that we have.
Absolutely. And I 100% agree. And it's been something that I've been working on conceptualizing my whole residency. And part of this podcast is to try to conceptualize osteopathic medicine. But the more that I learn about it, the more I'm like, whoa, the more I don't know.
The bigger, the longer the definition gets.
and then it's so multifaceted. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. says, you know, we're functional neurologists. And I'm like, okay, yeah. But what about the emotional side of a person?
Mm-hmm.
What about the circulatory system? What about the lymphatics? You know, there's so many different ways to define it. And I was talking to one doctor and he said, you know what, Ben? I stopped explaining osteopathic medicine to the patients. I get their consent for treatment. I treat them. And then I ask, do you have any questions about what I did or what this kind of medicine is? And many times he said, patients will just say, okay, I understand it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
This was different than chiropractic. I can't quite put my finger on it, but having been to chiropractic, having been to you, there's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I'm just throwing in the towel and I'm waving the white flag right now of, you know, my whole career, people will say, oh, you're like a chiropractor. Oh, you're like a physical therapist. I'm just like, okay, I can say whatever I want, but you're probably still going to think that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not disagreeing with you that I think it's very important that we define and explain what we do. But at the same time, I realize that, at least in my lifetime, it's just something that I'm just going to have to probably accept and be okay with.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, doing my best to define what we do.
Absolutely. What do you think about that? Yeah, I love the kind of, well, let me show you, like, rather than, you know, like, oh, well, what is osteopathic manipulation? What is an osteopathic doctor? Like, I feel like the actions do speak much louder than words. And I agree with you. It is one of those things. I never say, oh, well, we're not massage therapy or we're not physical therapy. Cause I'm like, well, we all share these similar ideologies and we trade back and forth. And then there's been communication between all these things. But we are somehow our own thing also.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I want to end with this question because you all have been very generous with your time. what advice do you both have, being osteopathic medical students, what do you have, what kind of advice do you have for other osteopathic medical students when it comes to OMT? Was that a clear enough question?
Yes. For me, I think the advice I would give is that the ability to use your hands to treat patients safely and effectively is such a powerful thing. Do not stop short of not going further to what you're capable of doing. I think us as individuals, we see it now that we're very capable of kind of treating different dysfunctions and kind of helping the patient restore or kind of, improve their dysfunctions and kind of restoring that back, but also kind of combining that with, medicine and preventative strategies and kind of just making sure that their quality of life improves significantly, or at least trying to for the most part. So just never stop short of what you can do with OMT. Go even further than you ever thought you could. And you'd be surprised at what you're capable of and how you can truly impact your patients. That's kind of the advice that I would give to osteopathic medical students.
You've really taken Dr. Blakemore's words to heart, Dahlia.
I really have. I have to thank him.
You've embodied it. That's great. What do you have, Emma? What advice do you have?
Yeah, I absolutely love the have the confidence in yourself and have the courage and perseverance to continue to ask to incorporate the osteopathic manipulative medicine during your first 2 years or whatever your school's use of education for osteopathic manipulative medicine. Really take advantage of that. Remember that this is the extra training we get, the extra anatomy. Even if you want to become a neurosurgeon, you can benefit from learning the anatomy of OMT, of focusing in on these things. Even if you're but I'm gunning for this and I'm going to focus in and study all these neural pathways. There's so many benefits that you can draw from learning it. So just remembering to continue that perseverance. And even if people are you don't need to do that, or I don't have the time to do that. There truly is the time to do those things. And as somebody who's going into residency, so already getting, especially in family medicine, inundated with billing codes and RVUs and all these things, it is still worth it. It is very much so still worth it. You can just keep the heart, keep the flame going.
Yeah, that's great. Any plugs you both want to make for anything? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you got a music concert coming up that you're playing at, or a book you got coming out. I don't know.
In all our spare time, we have our own novel coming out.
No, it's not totally fine.
No. I mean, the one plug, which I mentioned in the very beginning, it's whoever or any student that's going into their clerkships, really consider doing an OMM elective, whether it's inpatient or outpatient. Because that'll be the one time, or not the one time, that'll be the time where you really truly see OMM, ONMM, really applied in real life for the most part. You've spent 2 years working with med students and working with professors, hearing their anecdotes about the power of OMM, really see it for yourself. I'll believe it when I see it type of mentality. I think that's something that's really important. So that's a plug for that. But I think we've already mentioned that during this podcast. But I just wanted to mention it again.
Yeah, that's great. Do you mind, both of you, if I include your emails in the podcast in case students want to reach out to you with questions?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you both for your time. You're both going to be fantastic physicians. I'm excited to see what the future holds for you both. And yeah, thanks again for sharing your experiences.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us on.
Wait, Dr. Okay. Green, have you let your audience know where your future holds? We kind of talked about what our future kind of is. Dr. Green, have you talked about where your future is going?
I don't know that I have, but I will be heading to Detroit Medical Center to do a sports medicine fellowship.
Yay. So,
about that.
That's so exciting. Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you guys. Okay, well, you both have a great evening. It was a pleasure talking to you and listening to your stories.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
Bye. You
too. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you would like to reach out to either Dahlia or Emma, you may find their emails in the show notes. Reach out to the podcast at the onmmpodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, or if you would like to be on the podcast. As always, be well, be curious, and spread osteopathy.